in the movie, one of the great movies of all times, called The Third Man. And I looked on the web, I couldn't find anything which identified places in the movie with places in Vienna, so I made a web page. And there exists a web page. If you Google Third Man and Unruh, you will find that web page which identifies almost every single scene in the movie. When I came here, the Waterloo Record had an article of one of the people in Waterloo who was actually a cinematographer on The Third Man. And so I want to know as much as I can about The Third Man, and I got Silke and Ralph to invite Willie Nassau, who is one of the cinematographers on that movie, to come here and give us a short talk about his experiences with that movie. How many of you have seen the movie? If you haven't seen the movie, see it. It really is one of the great movies of the 20th century. It was voted the top movie by something like the British cinematographers of the 20th century. This was back in the year 2000. So go see that movie. But in the meantime, we're going to hear a little bit about Mr. Nassau's experiences with that movie.
Please. Well, thank you very much. I assume it's Professor Unruh.
Unruh, yes.
Unruh is right. Thank you very much. I put together a PowerPoint presentation that would have gone a little beyond the talk, but because we are, I don't know whether we have a time problem, I naively had assumed that there would be some audience coming in and so on. So for beginning it, I brought a disc with the Harry Lime theme. So we'd have to get you into the right mood. I'm glad we got it on. So because I timed it, I was told to time it for 30 seconds, that would be easier, but 30 minutes. And of course, I had the audio synchronized, so I will have to run it by hand because otherwise I think we'd be running very much over the time. So we got the music to get you into the right mood, I hope. I suppose I didn't watch when Professor Unruh asked how many had seen the film. How many had seen the film? Oh, quite a few. I tell you, I was not talking about the film too much. I think I was to talk about Vienna at this time, and I will start off, go informally. I will forget my wonderful written text, and I will try to fly it for a while just by the seat of our pants. When you remember what the film begins and ends, is this alley that you see here on the side, on the famous Vienna cemetery, the central cemetery, where supposedly Harry Lime was buried, and in fact he was not. But to get into the thing how I got involved into the Harry Lime, I had been working with the British 8th Army in Austria and photography and film. So that is really, and television later became my stuff. So when Alexander Korda, the owner of London Film, and of course also a former film producer in Europe, discovered that he had an account of money sitting in Vienna that he had put in before the war, and surprise, surprise, after the war, it turned out that there was some of that money still available. He also had Alexander Korda, had Graham Greene, as a guest, and Graham Greene had written a novel sort of on the movie, and he asked Alexander asked Graham Greene whether he would write a film script. Greene didn't want to have to do it at all, so he had to do a lot of persuasion to get him to write that script, but eventually the script was done, and the director that was hired was Carol Reed, who already had made a name for himself in various films and had done a lot of work on the film style. And this is where I suppose The Third Man, some people call it a film noir. I do not know. I am supposed to teach film history, and I've never quite found out what film noir really is meaning. But I think about Truffaut and Godard and some French filmmakers, and I don't think that the film was a film noir in the sense it was still a feature story. But the interesting thing, and that's where I come in as a cinematographer, was that it would break with the rules of filmmaking from Hollywood. And of course, if we tried in Europe always to imitate Hollywood in the technology. Normally when Hollywood has some large outside scenes, they would have built them in the studio, and the studio was an easy place to light, was an easy place to record sound, but they certainly would not go into miles and miles of bombed out city. So the task of doing this movie in Austria was a difficult task. And Alexander Korda's brother, Vincent Korda, who turned out to be the designer of the film, came to Vienna and was looking for some cinematographer, was looking for some movie person who could speak English and help them setting that up. So this is where I came in, lucky as I was 24 years old at that time. I'd been for 4 years working in movies, but a thing of that kind, I had no idea that this was going to be a real big one. So Vincent Korda and his assistant, Mrs. Montague, came to Vienna and said, we have to now see that we find the sites for the movie. So we had a script. And I have to say that Mr. Reed was a fabulous director. With all the film directors I ever worked, he's one of them I worship, because he was so different from what an image of a famous film director is. He didn't yell, he didn't jump around like people in Hollywood do. He was quiet and peaceful, and he was an angel of patience. He had to be an angel of patience, because almost everything that could go wrong went wrong. When you are on miles of rubble and you have to set up lights and you have to have sound and you have to set a camera. We are now spoiled in filmmaking in our modern days, because first of all, we don't use any film anymore. So that's, some people say, is a disadvantage. But since we are using digital media, of course, the digital media can be manipulated more in post-production, and all the mistakes can be fixed in post-production. People don't like to hear that, but it is a fact. With film, you cannot fool around. If you haven't got it right, you have a real problem to fix it later. So we had to work with film, and we had to work with very limited light situations, and we knew we had to do a lot of it during the night. So there was a real technical problem. Yeah, the technical problem was the audio, of course. Again, when you're doing a movie in the studio, there's no problem. The audio is easy. But if you're working in a big city, your audio is a problem. Even today, you have that friend that Air Canada flies over while you just have your hundreds take of a love scene. So all that you have to transform now into atmosphere of Vienna. And this is what we found. So for several weeks, Korda and Mrs. Montague and I, we had rented one of the very few cars. There were no automobiles in Vienna. They just had disappeared. So we found an Austrian, ex-Austrian taxi driver who had an ex-Austrian, about 10-year-old limousine, and rented him. It turned out he was a fabulous character, typical Viennese driver. He knew everybody, and he had an answer for all problems. It made my life very much easier, because I was supposed to be the fixer. When you have location shooting today on film, you go to Afghanistan or you go there, even to Paris, you hire a person who is a fixer, and he has to always try to get you out of trouble. So because we had Mr. Smolka with us, it was much easier for me. But if you have to see the situation, of course, Austria at that time had no more existing film industry. The Vienna film studios that had a good reputation in the past had been destroyed. The equipment had been carried away. And Vienna was separated into four political zones. You had a French, a Russian, an English, and an American zone. And we had the central district, the first district in Vienna, that was run each month by a different power. The British and the Americans got along reasonably well. Of course, our idea was as much we could work with the British, that would have been much easier, and we tried. But several things we had to be doing in the Russian zone. And at this time, the big friendship between the Russians and the British had already begun getting big holes. And for instance, one rule was set out. The rule was set out that if we were going to shoot in the Russian zone, they had to have a Russian camera crew, and they had to have always Russian members watching what we were doing. The Russians were not totally wrong with that, because just at the same time, and I was unfortunately also working for this group, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was shooting a film in Vienna that was called Vespers in Vienna, or The Red Danube. And that was, if you could say, an anti-Russian propaganda film that was won. And the Russians didn't get out of that film very well. So I can imagine that the Russians were not too friendly when there was now another crew trying to do something like that, despite the fact that we had absolutely no trouble to get themselves understanding, but they were watching us. They also didn't like the idea of bringing the British equipment in the Russian zone. So in the months when the Russians were in command in Vienna, in the center, we could go to the English district, but we could not, with our cameras, with the British equipment, go into the Russian zone. So we had to find some cameras. And all the German stuff had gone, of course. Eventually, we ended up with some French equipment, and some of the equipment was used for that. I am fighting the time, so I'm not going to get too much into the detail. But it would give you an idea about the problems we had to prepare that film for about a year in advance. Now, the actors, that was, by the way, one of the things in Vienna that still revived, had been survived in a way. Half of the wagons had been burned out, but you can still go into Austria now. It's operating again. Not only the big eye in England, but we still have the Riesenrad, the big wheel in Austria. So the hiring of the staff was another situation. The British film unions were not extremely keen to let the Austrians work on it. One of the reasons was, of course, none of us working, we had to have a background check, a political background check, because of the years that were before. Several of the Austrian actors and several of the Austrian technicians did not qualify. I was lucky I got through that one. So it was no problem for me. But many of the actors that they hired in Austria had to be, some of them had to came back from immigration, and therefore they were not really very well known. But eventually we got working together, and 60 members of the British group, and imagine bringing 60 live bodies from England and put them into Vienna of that day. You have to house them, you have to feed them. So where would one go in Vienna if you won't have a good housing? You, of course, go to the Hotel Sacher. And the Hotel Sacher, indeed, was available. It had been already working with the British Army. So the English people were housed in the Hotel Sacher. And the Austrians were glad if they could go in and out once. But we were really lucky as the Austrian people, because they were going to pay us union fees in Austrian shillings. You could have probably just gotten a few cigarettes on the black market for that sort of money. The Austrian money wasn't good for anything. So they decided not only to pay us what the British unions would allow them to pay us. And the other thing about the British film unions is their agreement was in the credits, the Austrian crew would get no credits. That's why you don't have my name on the film. That doesn't kill me to death. Especially I was just a young student who was beginning to start learning it. But some buzzard people didn't like that very much. And of course, the Austrian actors managed to get some of their names on the credits. Now, when you are now looking around, we are thinking about lighting situations like that in the middle of the night. there was not enough lighting equipment available in Austria. They brought a huge generator truck from England, and they brought British big lights and British electricians, and they brought British cables. And we soon found out that with the British system having not 50 cycles, but at the time they were having 25 cycles and had different frequencies, or as in the film, you use a lot of carbon arcs, and the carbon arc lights that give you the intensity that you need were running with direct current. So we had to lay miles of cable of the direct current into the sewers. And the sewers were not a very friendly place for cables. So we had a lot of technical problems. And we had problems that sometimes when we worked, some houses would fall in on us. With other words, a lot of unexpected things. But to say one of the good things that happened, and I don't have any pictures of that, but I tell you, they hired one of the big restaurants of Vienna, old traditional restaurant that was located in the former imperial palace, which is called the Hofburg. And the Hofburg restaurant, unfortunately, doesn't exist any longer. Hofburg restaurant would be open day and night and would cook wonderful meals, and they brought the food in. So getting 5 meals a day was, for all of us Austrians, more important than being paid in money. And why 5 meals? Because they already had found out that one crew was not enough to shoot that film. It eventually, we had an A crew, of course, with the top camera people from England. We had another crew who was not the top. The B group was, of course, still good British camera crew. And we had an Austrian crew who just did what they could to fill in. But they all went 24 hours around, so whoever was hungry could go to the restaurant and have a good meal. Now, the other thing we needed a car. And cars, again, were very scarce. So this, what you see here, is belief. I don't think it was a Mercedes. I don't really recall exactly, but it was the limousine that we had. And in some of the wild scenes where they drive around, this on another car did most of the car shots. In the meantime, Mr. Korda, Ms. Montague, and I had the car to go around and shoot background. And background shooting, we could not shoot with the lights that you see here. This is when you already had approximately 600 kilowatts, 600,000 watts of light. Nobody would use that much light today, and certainly nobody would use in Vienna that type of light, because if we didn't have the British generator, probably Vienna would have used all the power to get the light power that we had. But because of the carbon arcs, because of the size of the situation, imagine that big building in the back that still exists, it's on the fire, and I'm sure you've seen it, to light that up. So the camera technique had to be changed in something that hadn't been done before or wasn't like to be. In filmmaking and in digital photography, you can't have an absolute black because the neutrons, all the electrons go crazy in there and they try to put the game up and fill it up so you get noise in the black. You always have to have a little coverage in the black. On the movie film, when you haven't got a little light on it, you have a clear film, and even in post-production, you had a bit of a problem, so nobody dared to do it. But as you can see, Robert Kreska, and I'm talking about the cameraman or director of photography, as we say today, Robert Kreska got an Oscar for the camera work for this film. And Robert Kreska told us that rules don't exist unless you can break them. So he right away started breaking the lighting rules by not lighting scenes that or lighting parts of the film that he absolutely needed. And this is where you see a lot of black coming into, and you can see that the white is already washing out. So we had problems with this too, but it was a new way of making movies. Now you can see here how the big wheel actually looked after the 1944 problems, after 1944 big air aggression to Vienna. So the cars had to be quickly built. at least we had a few cars on the wheel. And of course, not Harry Lime, but his friend was, of course, or Rollo Martin is looking up here. But there's another interesting thing in the background. You see there a little lorry, and you see people on a pile of rubbish. There were incredible amounts of rubbish in Vienna, and at this time, there were still not enough men to work. Many of the men had still been in, up in the camps and so on. So hundreds of women were shoveling day and night to just get the main roads. And I had, before that, I made a documentary about what we call the rubble women in Vienna. And we found that part of that then became background of the shooting of Vienna of that time. And of course, eventually some cars had been put on a big wheel, and we were looking for special places. I once discovered in the first district in an old house, I discovered the staircase. And of Carol Reed was very typical for that. He could make a quick decision. Yes, we will have in one of the chase, we'll have a situation where Orson Welles runs through this staircase. Even that one still exists today.
You know where that is today?
The staircase is yes. Near the Judenplatz in the first district.
Okay,
unless they took the staircase out and put another one in, and
well,
I don't know about it.
That was one of the few places I never found.
It turned out that I was afraid of this. I thought, I am sure that Professor Unruh will know much more about the third man than I ever will know. Not only he was doing very careful research, and I have to have 64 years of memory for it. So we have to work with it. But just to get, I'll try to stay a little more on the technical end where I know I can hopefully hold myself. So when I started photographing stills, I came up with my trusted Rolleiflex, which at the time was a pretty respectable camera. I also had a Leica, but 35 millimeter film wasn't taken very serious. But Vincent Cordier said, no, you cannot use that. You have to use a very large, full format 8x10 plate camera, because some of the stuff that we shoot will have to be rebuilt in a studio in England. And we have to make enlargements that are big enough to make what we call film backings or photo backings. So all we had to shoot was with a big camera. And we had a bit of a problem sending these things to England unprocessed, because my little lab could not handle this material. So we were never quite sure what we had, but this is the camera I had to use for still photography. And my involvement was much more in still photography than in a movie at that time. I must have shot 3,000 or 4,000 still shots that were used. And you can see that was the type of camera we used for the still photos. Now, the other thing was, of course, finding the locations. And as we were looking around locations, we saw that part of the Vienna River, the Wien Fluss, is really joining itself with the Vienna sewage system. And we needed support from the Vienna police, because we couldn't have really worked with all these PKOs. People were a little odd at the time, so police was a good thing to have. As it turned out, our contact man for the Austrian police was the commander of the sewer brigade. And the Austrians had a special sewer brigade who were, their job was to catch criminals if they ever got into the sewer. So with the whole chase of the third man eventually was put into the sewer, and the script had to be changed, because this was certainly the location. It was about the most horrible location you can imagine to shoot a movie in. But what we also found out when we were starting to get things a little organized, and you can see that this was our everyday shooting situation, was in these places. And the Vienna police people were a great help about it. Here is, for instance, the Vienna police opening one of these metal openings. Again, you may have seen it, is near the Künstlerhaus on the Karlsplatz. And there they were going in the chase for the third man. And the chap in the center was the, that famous commander of the sewer police, who persuaded us, oh, the sewers are a wonderful place to be all the time. And he turned out to be a really interesting character, and he was a very good actor too. So again, breaking the rules of the British film unions, our Austrian police commander became, he played himself. He was the chief of police who was organized in the chase. Now you can see that was Vienna under the Russian occupation, the parliament building, and you have happy-go-lucky Russian troops who were usually going to look for a drink or something, or some entertainment. And they had absolutely no respect for us when we were filming. They came and drove right through, and we had to just go for another day and do it again. Now, of course, you have here the 4M Jeep. When the Russian zone, or the center of Vienna was Russian, then the Russian policeman was in charge. But you had the British and the American and the French with him. So we tried to pick the days when the British were in charge. Didn't always work out that way. And we just found out already that at time there was quite a bit of difference of opinion between them. Eventually, of course, the Hotel Sacher was the place where it all ended up. The portier, or the concierge of the Sacher, who had been there for years and years, was again a person who knew everybody, who could fix things and helped around. And then came another thing. One night was party time. The British crew and some of the Austrian crew went to a place that is called a Heurigen. A Heurigen for a Viennese is a place on the outskirts of Vienna in the suburbs where they have legally the right to serve their own wine. And I grew up in one of these things. I can tell you the wine that we had when I was a kid was terrible. Nobody would drink it today because they didn't know much about winemaking. But the Heurigen was what the Viennese would go to drink. Heurigen means it is wine that is not as old as 1 year. It has to be last year's wine. So you went to these places, the wine was served in big, like beer steins, and in most of them was no music. They were pretty poor places. People brought their own food. One night, and I wasn't there, I was not when Anton Karas showed up. One night, a just wandering zither player came in. They didn't have a permanent orchestra. They had people going around, like what they call the Schrammeln, which is the Austrian band of three musicians, or they had zither players, or sometimes a violin player, who come and entertains the audience and then passes his hat and goes on to the next. So one evening, Anton Karas walked in with his zither and started to play. And turned out that Carol Reed got fascinated with his music. And he said, this is the man who will have to write the music for our film. Now, for Anton Karas, that wasn't an easy thing. He was a simple man from the people who he wasn't very well to do, had never had to do anything with film at all. But eventually, he was persuaded, maybe there was enough Austrian wine in it, was persuaded to do it. Now, Anton Karas, as you probably know, became world famous on this. The film he played for royal people, he played for the Queen, he played in the States, and of course the records were selling very well, but he couldn't handle it. He was a man who could not handle the business end of it. So when it was all over, and he must have had a fair amount of money in the bank, he lost it within a year. People were stealing him blind. He opened a Heurigen in Vienna. He wanted to make what was called a noble Heurigen, which is meaning a fancy Heurigen. And of course, he had to hire a chef who ran the show, and he could not make ends meet. Eventually, his brother turned it into a carpentry shop. For a few years, it was a carpentry shop, not a restaurant. And eventually, famous Anton Karas died not much richer than he had been. I always felt so sorry for him that I thought if I ever would want to make a movie, I would have liked to take the story of Anton Karas and making it into a biographical movie. Never came about it. Now, as far as Austrian actors, some actors had been in a bad name, let's see, with the Nazis. So a lot of those we got for the film, we were allowed to hire them. And this Mr. Oscar Breyer, Siegfried Breyer, was, for instance, one of the Austrians. And then, of course, you have Alida Valli. Alida Valli, some people said of her she was going to be the new Greta Garbo. She had been born in Yugoslavia as the daughter of a Yugoslavian aristocrat. She was, no question, a very pretty lady. You can imagine, I was 24 years old. I was impressed. And I had a nice assignment that they told me, you go around with Alida Valli and photograph her in Austrian dresses. Not all the Austrian dresses that she had would be used in the film, but Alida Valli certainly liked the dresses, so she bought a lot of these Austrian dirndl dresses and used some of them in the film. Of course, here is we going, Alida Valli on the left-hand side, and one of the owners of one of the saloons in Vienna showing her one of the dresses that she, in fact, then wore in the film for a short time. Now, of course, Joseph Cotten was, I think he got more from the movie than Orson Welles. Orson Welles was the big famous man who gave his name. And Orson Welles was a difficult person to work with. If it hadn't been for a director like Carol Reed, I think they would have come to a beating, because Orson Welles wanted to direct himself. He could do it very well, but it didn't always match the script very well. So some ideas, you have heard of the famous words where it came up with the cuckoo clock. People knew it. That was Orson Welles' idea. That was not in the script. Came not from... But the two of them got along because the director was so nice. Now you have some of the American actors who were disciplined Hollywood people, and you told them, do a scene five times. They would do it five times, and there was no problem. Orson Welles, when he had enough, he went to the Hotel Sacher, and that was it. You had to take the shot or leave it, and if you didn't like it, well, you may as well have 60 people sitting there around with lights on and no Orson Welles. So it was certainly not easy to work with. And yeah, I got along with Cotten very well. When we come to this, I'm speeding up here a little bit. I like railroads. Some people who know me probably have found out it's one of my hobbies to have worked with railroads. So I loved railroads only at the time. And we brought one of the very few big steam locomotives into the Russian zone. The Russians would go and snatch the steam locomotives very quickly. They took about 100 and took them to Russia, which was a problem because they had a different width of track, but they worried about it later. So we transported that locomotive to Vienna just for the scenes where Alida Valli, or Anna in, as in the film, where she's supposed, with the courtesy of the British, to leave Vienna. She doesn't do, of course, she stays in Vienna, but for one night, we had the problem of lighting and organizing the station. And that was one of the things where, again, I came in with my railroad knowledge a lot. I have a little more of Karas, and I have, of course, a picture of, not Graham Greene, but Carol Reed, who, if I learned things, I learned from Carol Reed how to direct, and I learned from Anton Karas how to operate a camera non-conventionally. Our lighting was following new systems. We didn't always have tungsten type light. We had these huge carbon arc lights, which can also give a lot of heat, and who had a tendency to explode. Sometimes bird flu in them. When a bird hits the carbon arc, they would explode. It would burn up in an arc and it would go. So you can imagine there were some problems. Now, some of you may remember the old man with the balloons. It was characteristic of Carol Reed that he would hire people who would stand around. Sometimes we had a crowd standing around as we filmed. And some night this guy came up wandering all around, said, I want to sell air balloons. The assistants chased him away and said, no, Carol Reed said, this is the man I need, and we hire him right away. So he played that scene where, in the end, beginning of the chase, he walks in the middle of the chase and tries to sell a balloon. Now they have this place in the middle of the big square called the Freiung, where there's a typical Austrian thing. The French call this a Litfaßsäule, but the Austrians just had these, they were of metal and they were for posters. But they had a door in it and stairs went on the inside into the sewers. We didn't know that. The canal police would tell us about that. But then, of course, there was the third man is seen for a moment. You remember the scene where the little cat sits at the shoe of Harry Lime. And then Harry Lime is seen here, and then he disappears. And nobody knows, including the police, where he went. He went down there. So he's gone. And he is, in fact, down into the sewers. And where the final part of the chase eventually comes to the end, and you can again imagine the trick we had to do. We had to have light that would give us, because you have to have reflection. If you want to see it, you have to put on some light surface or a shiny surface. You have to put some light. So what we first did, we sprayed that part of the sewer with lacquer, because it wasn't always wet enough. It was wet enough for us to not like it, but it was not wet enough to give. So it had to be sprayed with a lacquer, and then we had to watch that our shooting, that the only light that we used was one of the huge arcs at the end and reflected in this way. But we had some other experiences in these sewers. We had gone on a morning and we picked one that I really liked because there was some sort of a barrier. You remember in the film that he goes sideways through the water. So we liked that, and the water was flowing over. It was not too difficult. The light, we brought our lights, starting in the morning. By about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we were ready to shoot. We brought in Orson Welles. Out of a sudden, there was some noise above, and then a big flood of brown stuff came from the top. Incredible. It was like a flood, it was like a deluge. And the canal police already knew that. They laughed about it, said, oh, that is a special effect, we didn't talk about it. So what was it? We were just below the Vienna Volksoper House. One of the Vienna Opera houses, they had an afternoon show of Don Giovanni or whatever it had been. And it was the break time. And the visitors in the opera at the break time can have a glass of champagne, but they do something else also in the break time. And when about 400 people do that, you know whether you get quite a deluge. So that was one of the experiments that we had. We were lucky that the Austrian crew had been given, our clothing wasn't up to all that. We all had been given British duffel coats. The wonderful woolly with a hood. Oh, I had mine still in 1959 when I came to Canada. I loved it. So that was certainly one way that helped us a little bit in around the sewers. And then, yes, please.
So it said that Orson Welles didn't want to go into the sewers and that those scenes were actually shot in the
He did. He was bitching all the time. But he did all the scenes. There were no extras.
Okay, so
there was no stand-ins. Orson Welles did what he had to do. He did it reluctantly, but he did it, eventually he did it well, there's no question about it. But he, sometimes after a while he got sick of it and went away, but he came back on the next day. Now this is the door where the shoes, and you can see the little cat there. This is where the shoes, and where of course Harry Lime for the first time is seen alive by Rollo Martin. Again, another thing that we did, and that we would not do nowadays, is the way the shadow projections are. You can see that in many of the shots, you have big shadows going under the background, for instance here. Now, what we are using today in filmmaking is called source lighting. And when you are source lighting, you'd mean that you shoot in the light that is possible that you see. If I take a movie of you, this is our source lighting, and I have to light it in a way that the people sitting here don't have any light from down below, or they may have a little bit light from the door, but it has to be true to the source. Now, source lighting in this you couldn't do because you would have had a huge light in the ground to project that shadow. So you're breaking some rules of photography. But of course, some of the effect of the film were indeed the source lighting, where the shadow of Harry Lime comes around. And talk about the cameras, the French cameras that we were allowed to have in the Russian zones are cameras that are called debris camera. And you can see, we called it the golden camera. There's some stuff that I was allowed to shoot on the Reichsbrücke, because the Russians wouldn't like the English crew coming there, and certainly wouldn't like the English camera. So this is what I shot with this thing. And I'm just getting a little bit towards the end. We have fought the time as good as I could. And as you all know, the film ends with sort of sad character on the alley in a big cemetery, where first, of course, Rolly Martin walks and hopes that he would reunite himself with Alida Valli, with Anna, but she walks away on him, and that is the end of the movie. It was also the very first scene that we shot, and was the very first location where I began to work on my very first day when the actual shooting began. And I thank you for your patience. Yes, I will try to answer if I can.
Maybe Bill has a few more, or I'll go ahead. So the way you describe it, it seems that they were, I don't want to say improvisation on the set, but many opportunities were taken to take advantage of the old man with the balloons, or, you know.
Yeah, of course, this is something that in later years I always found, that you sometimes find characters somewhere that you would like to put in the film. But Carol Reed got away with it. Some Austrian directors did not get away with this, because the unions hold their hands on it. But we, many things were, the change of the script had to be made on the moment, because something happened there that was good to be put in the movie.
I was wondering about the little boy.
Yeah, I had a picture of it. I had to cut things because we're fighting time. Little boy turned out, it was a little Viennese boy that they met, and they said, oh, it would be an extra little thing when actually Rollo Martin gets accused to be a murderer by him. And he's supposed to be the son of the actor that plays the house master there at this, and it's on the Franz Josef Square. I'm sure you looked up in the, on the balcony where he stood. So the little boy we saw in the audience. And his parents were persuaded, and he turned out to be very good. He's going around crying, murder, murder.
Very creepy.
Yeah.
How long did the filming last?
Well, I had started in the preparation in end of 1947. So with other words, we worked almost a year on the preparation. And the shooting in Vienna took, I'm not absolutely correct, but I'm sure it took about 6 months. And the shooting in England, where I was not, I did not get into England, but the shooting in England would have been in post-production another 3 months. So the film eventually was released towards 1950, and I believe it won an Oscar then in 1952 So. Take three, you can say almost 3 years from the conception to the ending. It made no money. It was very well known, but it didn't make a profit. That's something that today is a different idea when you make big monster films of that. But the money had been there in Vienna and used up for, nobody was getting very excited about the fact. And the Austrians hated it, because you can imagine, the Austrians didn't get out too well of that movie. So the Austrians didn't. They boycotted it, and they didn't like it. The interesting thing you may know is that the Austrians do not like The Sound of Music. The whole world likes The Sound of Music, but the Austrians again hate it, because it shows some of their black chapters that they would rather forget. Another question?
If not, you will also be taking part in the conference. Then also, if you have some other questions, there will also be the opportunity.
I got to ask you about some of those things.
Yeah, please. I mean, we are still staying together, so
yes, I
can still answer questions.
Yes. That's what he was saying. I mean, that staircase is an absolutely wonderful, that circular staircase is an absolutely wonderful staircase, and I've always wondered where it was shot. I found one or two that were similar, but not the same.
Well, the last time I looked in Vienna, and that goes about 15 or 20 years ago that I was in that house,
right. It
was still there. And you have a location that is called Am Hof.
Yeah.
At Am Hof, and you have the clock there.
Yeah.
And in one of the side streets, it's called the Judengasse. And there was a synagogue that had been destroyed during the war.
Right.
And in one of these old houses, that's where we found the staircase. And it was the son of a gondolite, you can imagine, one of those things.
It's a wonderful staircase.
So eventually, I was lucky that I was there. I learned a lot, and of course, eventually I became really, I made a documentary filmmaker, and then I ended up at Wilfrid Laurier University teaching film. And now I'm retired, I still make about 2 little documentaries a year. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.